Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Carolyn Birdsill. Her book Radiophilia has just been published with Bloomsbury Press as part of a series called The Study of Sound. This book is an effort to understand, historicize, and theorize radiophilia, or love of radio. Its broad temporal and geographic scope makes it useful for so many of us who write and think about radio. It's also very readable and accessible, so great for students. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Carolyn. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Alejandra.
Let's just jump right into the beginning. Actually, even before the beginning, let's talk about the title.
Sure.
What is the concept of radiophilia and why do we need it?
Sure thing. So I had the feeling already for some time that other fields around radio studies had done a better job at thinking, for instance, about audiophilia or musicophilia. And I started reading quite a bit of fan studies literature and noticed that almost no radio was covered in that discipline or subfield. And so bit by bit, I started to think about what radiophilia might mean, that we might think about the love for radio. And because it was around the time of 100 years of radio in a number of countries, I started to think about it as an expansive concept that might cover early wireless and early radio practices, amateur radio practices as well, through to the present day situation of internet radio and digital audio-based formats like podcasting. So it is quite a flexible concept in the sense that I'm thinking about radiophilia as a love for or a strong attachment to radio, but I'm trying to think about how the different conditions, forms, and media assemblages of radio may actually differ across time and space and give us different instantiations or contexts for these diverse possibilities of what radiophilia might be. So I'm thinking about this love of radio and or a strong attachment to radio. It doesn't have to always be love. It could be more intermittent or fleeting, but I do think about it as something that we can examine across a roughly 100-year period.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because this is not a long book. It's a kind of a perfect length for, as far as I'm concerned, but you do pull together, you know, 100 years of time and a lot of space. You make a point to sort of decenter the North American / European emphasis of radio studies, and you do kind of roam across the globe. And so I just wanted to ask you, how did you manage that? How did you make the decisions about what to put in, what to leave out?
Sure. I mean, at some level, I had to tell myself that it wasn't possible to do everything, and rather to be illustrative in some of the things I was doing. So making certain moves that show us certain things about different contexts, global contexts of radio, or situations of how radio has been adopted and used, globally. And so I hope that my reader also understands that as I kind of move between different places, whether that's Asia Pacific or Central and South America, Asia and Russia, as well as thinking about different contexts in Europe and North America, I'm trying to work in a more illustrative way to say, yes, while the dominant research has told us that radio was domesticated in a certain way and brought into predominantly nuclear family home settings from the 1920s onwards, and that there's a particular pathway for how we've been taught to think about that in the context of North America and Western Europe, there may be other ways in which radio has been defined and used that may be public settings, other forms of family, friend, workplace scenarios that are not just limited to this early narrative about the domestic hearth. So I hope that my reader understands I'm not trying to do everything, but through moving through different contexts, I'm reflecting back on some of the norms that have become too easily accepted. And at the same time, I'm not dismissing those norms, because I try to understand, like I do use examples from North America and Western Europe to help us understand how certain notions of, say, the male inventor genius, or like a certain type of history of radio's introduction and adoption, have become so entrenched. So how certain institutions such as museums, timelines, exhibitions or encyclopedias work to create the knowledge of what happened from radio's earliest beginnings until the present.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things, another one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because I've been reading your work for a long time, and one of the things that's so interesting is the way you do lay out a narrative and make a compelling case for it, but then also poke at it. Kinds of ways. It's one of my favorite things about your work, and so I wonder if you can talk about what other narratives you might be poking at in this book.
Sure. I mean, that's a very nice compliment, and I've never heard that before, but now that you say it, I think you're right. Maybe it's somehow, I think we're taught, especially in the discipline of history, and I trained as a historian as well as a media scholar, to craft a narrative. And I think storytelling is something that I've really had to learn to do. It didn't come naturally in the kind of, let's say, history discipline to me. I had to really think about what does it mean to have an opening vignette and go somewhere with it and then wrap it up. And I think I realized that I struggle a bit with neat storylines. I'm happy to do a bit of beginning, middle, and end, but sometimes by the time I'm getting to the conclusion, I'm already starting to think, yes, but. And I think that's maybe, it probably happens to many people, is like, just when it seems too easy to wrap it up, you kind of want to think about counter arguments and counter examples to the thing you've just the thing you've just done. So I'm just thinking, what are the narratives? I mean, I think I just mentioned the male inventor genius.
Yes.
So I think that's something that I, until doing the research for this book, obviously, you know, was aware of its existence and its influence on early radio history or wireless radio history, with figures such as Marconi or Edison for recorded sound and so on. I think I hadn't quite realized how different types of genres or formats in the early decades of radio were so insistent on reproducing those narratives, whether it's in amateur radio magazines or in national yearbooks of radio, or like I said, in museums, early museums and exhibitions. It was really only when I started to look at photos and catalogs and different publications that I saw that almost every issue and every event had busts of Marconi and probably sometimes Tesla as well, and Edison, and had a lot of timelines and, you know, really kind of reproducing and reinforcing this emphasis let's say North American and Western European inventor geniuses in the history of radio. So I think it's something that the research really presented to me in a way I perhaps had underestimated in the past.
Yeah, and that just opens up space for thinking about things in a different way, even while, as you say, kind of maintaining that was an important part of radio. So I really like that.
Thank you.
I want to end with a discussion of affect and emotion, because I think that's something that it's another kind of framing that is really important to the book. But before we do that, I want to sort of talk about the categories around which you organized the book and the way that you decided to create these really kind of provocative themes of loving, knowing, saving, and sharing. So how did you come up with that? I mean, I would imagine that it was a long and difficult process of figuring out how to organize all of the material that you had.
To some degree, yes. And it was partially that, as I gathered the material for this research, that there was a sense of sort of, yeah, self-elective organization that I noticed certain patterns. And so even though to some degree I had an inkling that it might go in this direction prior to the research, I did notice, like, you know, already in the theories of love I was reading, they were talking of, and as well as fan studies, were talking about the relationship between love and affect with knowing and processes of let's say playful knowledge and hands-on knowledge. So, you know, some of it was coming from material, some of it was coming from the reading I was doing in feminist love studies and fan studies. But in terms of this particular organization, so as you mentioned, the focus of the four chapters is on loving, knowing, saving, and sharing, or we could say putting your love of radio on display. And I think what I did do is try to understand these sort of acts of doing, these kind of practice words, really as different aspects to this larger process. So I guess in the beginning, it's more of a theoretical chapter, the first chapter on loving, and that I'm really asking, like, what is the love of radio and how does one express this loving? So what are the different possible forms it takes on the side of the listener or the audience, but also what kinds of aspects are there to radio that serve as a kind of invitation to that love? So in a way, that first chapter is trying to think about the qualities of radio over time, but also what listeners or fans and audiences bring with their loving of radio. So it's not just something inherent to the medium or its functions or qualities at any one time, but something that comes from them and their kind of self-directed acts of attachment. And then the second one, I guess there was some really interesting work coming out of film studies that helped me think about this relationship between learning to love cinema in the 1910s and 20s in early cinephilic and film fan culture. So I really profited from reading that material that helped me think about how learning to love radio is hand in hand with processes of knowledge production, pedagogy, and so forth. And then I guess because of this emphasis on audiences and listeners and thinking about what they kind of, what practices they develop or what kinds of actions that might happen or forms of material culture around radio, that's where the second two chapters about saving and sharing come in. That I guess there's a little bit of a risk when you focus on loving and knowledge that you might stay a little bit on the institutional side. And I guess by thinking about saving the thing you love or sharing your love of radio or putting on display, I was really trying to think about, you know, what types of ways do people take the so-called ephemeral medium of radio and actually hold on to its bits and pieces, whether that's sound traces or non-sound traces like postcards or souvenirs or t-shirts or something else. And in a way, the sharing is thinking about both these individual dimensions to putting your love of radio on display or sharing it with others, as well as these more collective dimensions of practices like collective listening or group listening.
Yeah, I want to dig in a little bit more into each of these categories because I find
sure.
it fascinating. And I also think as you were talking, I think that there's room there to think about this kind of framing as being able to be like applicable to other forms of media as well. And I was actually thinking about, for example, in terms of loving, you really talk about the relationship to material culture. So it's less about, you know, your sources aren't people talking about how much they love radio, although there's a little bit of that, but it's really sort of what are the material cultures, what are the objects that sort of promoted this idea of the love for radio? And if you think about it, today, for example, you know, marketing of, let's just say, the iPhone, right? It's all about love. Like, do you love your phone, right? And,
sure.
And how is that even a question, right? So, so yeah, I would love to hear you talk more about this relationship to material culture.
Sure. I think, you know, you're pointing to something that I perhaps had a sense of, but I only really started to realize when conducting the research, which was that too often the ways in which media history, but also media studies, have been separated along lines of certain media and a kind of obsession with medium specificity means that we often talk about the film fan or the film audience, and we might talk about you know, magazine readers and the magazine reading audience, and to the same degree we talk about, you know, the radio listener and the radio audience. And still, even though there have been colleagues in radio studies that have very helpfully pointed to both overlaps in the industry between recorded music, cinema, and radio, as well as later television and so forth, I think, as well as then, you know, trying to think about the audiences as being audiences that read and consume visual imagery and also listen to the radio potentially at the same time, I had the feeling that we still had done too little to think about that in terms of crossover fandoms. You know, I think there still is a tendency to kind of parcel off our group of people for our own purposes, for the, you know, at the moment that they appear as a amateur radio fan, or at the moment that they appear as someone who writes a letter to a magazine, or they ring up a radio station. We want them to be a radio listener, and we kind of hog them for ourselves. And so I think part of what I was trying to make sense of is that, especially in this early period of the 1920s to 1940s, where we have quite a strong kind of intermedial culture around these different new media, like sound, film, radio, and modern illustrated magazine culture, that we might want to think about crossover fandoms, and that this is a template that helps us also understand the kind of the post-war period up until the present. So it was really that the early period of sort of 1910s, 1920s through to the war and early post-war period helped me to think about the ways in which a radiophilia would be fueled with print media and cinema and radio together, and not necessarily divorcing them from each other, and that indeed material cultural objects, whether they be illustrated magazines or a postcard or other, or even the radio receiver itself, like to think about how important material objects are, you know, in tandem with fueling or interacting with this love of radio. And I think the other thing I tried to think about was how adjacent hobbies feed into an interest in radio's content and listening to radio, since if we look from the very earliest period of radio, it's sport or say religious programs or educational programs or popular music that sort of define people's attractions to radio. So, you know, we have to always think about how maybe the kind of adjacent interests such as religious practice or consuming sport, you know, cross over and feed into this radiophilia.
Yeah, and that's related also to this question of knowing. And one of the things I found so useful and interesting is this notion of sort of textuality and intermediality, because it really opens up a kind of archive and a method. And I think that a lot of times historians of radio, I know I experienced this as well. We, you know, go to the sources, and if there's nothing sonic, then we start to look for text. And then, but the text is always sort of a way to get at what's happening on the radio. So you look sort of through the text, but what you're doing is something very different. You're looking at the text and telling us what that is telling us about, you know, the construction of this thing called radio. And I find that so fascinating.
Thanks. I think it is something that, you know, we do have to be also quite mindful of. At the moment, there are quite a lot of projects that are starting to do stuff around speech to text transcriptions of radio archival materials.
Right.
And I think there is a risk there. It's something that colleagues who work at archives tell me, is that when political scientists or historians often come to the archive, the first thing they ask is, do you have transcripts of yeah. your oral history collection or your radio collection? And when that's the case, they usually elect not to listen to the audio.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's also something methodologically speaking that we have to be also really mindful of, is that we ourselves, you know, in largely producing texts as scholars, that we might also have this same tendency to kind of default to transcripts or scripts. And you know, even though we always know that, you know, the thing that we're dealing with in the sound archive is still, you know, capturing one moment in a flow of radio on a particular radio day, I think we do have to be a bit mindful that we kind of have a textual default, that we still, even after the influence of sound studies, that, you know, I can also admit to it that I have this impulse as well.
Yeah, it's a kind of very tricky and complicated thing to figure out how to, I don't know, understand how text and sound are working together, but they're not the same thing, and they're
yeah.
kind of constructing each other. And I thought that chapter really kind of made me think about that a lot. In terms of saving, so archives, one of our favorite topics. I wanted to ask you actually just to talk about your favorite examples, because you have some great examples in that chapter. And there are lots of different kinds of saving. And so I wanted to ask you to talk about your favorite examples and which ones were the most surprising to you.
Sure. So in the third chapter on saving, I do have this division between kind of saving or collecting or preserving non-sound as well as sound materials. And I do sort of divide it up, hopefully not too artificially, but mainly just as a way for us to try to pass out a little bit the different types of saving that we encounter when it comes to the so-called ephemeral traces of radio across its century. And I think, interestingly, it is often that we think, oh, saving sound, that must be saving radio, that must be automatically it sounds. I think that's just something we kind of tend to think about, because we think, but of course, radio is a sound-based medium. But I think it was helpful for me to separate the two a little bit, just to then make sense of, you know, what the kind of range of practices are, especially when, you know, different listeners or groups of people either save in a way that's kind of quite specific, like one type of object, for instance, a certain type of postcard or certain types of buttons or badges, depending on what type of English you speak. So, you know, this kind of interest in, say, collecting around one announcer or one star or one station or one type of object. And then we have other people who might be more interested in, say, more merchandise that were giveaways from the station, or other similar types of, let's say, objects that came from people who worked in radio, like their own private materials. So actually, my favorite example is one that I opened the chapter with, and that's a colleague called Laura LaPlaca, who wrote a beautiful article about how radio historians and television historians are too critical of the archive, that they often arrive and say, but where are the things I'm looking for? I want everything to be here. And her argument is, you know, that kind of disappointment comes at the expense of acknowledging the extraordinary materiality of the things that have been preserved from radio and television history. And she's primarily looking at the US. And she's written this beautiful piece that I discuss in the book, where she's talking also about her own development as a private collector from her childhood onwards, and that she bought a pair of shoes from a a broadcast presenter, and she along with other objects she had ordered off eBay, you know, she labeled them, she ordered them. I think she polished the shoes now and then. And she talks in a very moving way about this process from being a child and teenage collector to being a broadcast archive professional. And I think it was that blurring also that she's like acknowledging that we do often have a blurring between these professional and so-called amateur roles when it comes to saving the traces of radio, that I found very persuasive and helpful in my thinking, that we don't sort of have this idea of the professional and the non-professional, where, you know, the non-professional are fans who are very emotional and not very organized in what they do, and that somehow the professional would be this very detached person who only applies professional archivist principles to the, but they that actually often that the professionals have a strong emotional connection to broadcasting that's actually really motivated them to go into this profession. So I think that was my favorite example. I mean, there are many examples of interesting objects people collected, whether they're vintage radios, postcards, making their own scrapbooks or so forth. But I think I found her story to be so moving and instructive that that's why I opened the chapter with a quote from her.
Yeah, I love that. And this leads us to sharing, which is also about objects. And one of the things that I noticed in this chapter, and I wanted to hear you talk more about, was this idea of nostalgia, because it seems to be really an important part of sharing and maybe the saving, right? There's this kind of built-in nostalgic kind of tone for the things that get saved and shared. And I wonder if you could talk about, you know, where does that come from and where does it leave us? Like, do we always need to talk about radio in nostalgic terms?
Interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, certainly I think in those two chapters, I talk about the emergence of old-time radio collectors. And I look in particular with those groups and how there's a strong pull towards collecting from their own youth. So the ways in which, what's called the golden age of American radio, started to be kind of formed as a theme, but also as a an object of desire, let's say, for collectors at the moment that they themselves, so some of those people were amateur collectors and some of them were people who worked in the broadcast industries themselves, at the moment that they started to move age-wise in their life cycle towards retirement. I do find it really interesting to think about this. In the book, I talk about how important it is to take into account the life cycle approach that's been advocated in fan studies research, because it does help us understand that there are certain ebbs and flows when it comes to memory practices and also affective practices around radio. I do think that nostalgia, kind of this process of thinking about your own earlier experiences and perhaps idealizing a better time in the past where we had a golden age of radio. Like, I do think it is productive. At the same time, I also tried to think about, again, similar to our story about inventive male geniuses in the 20s and 30s and how they were canonized, I also tried to think about the visibility of fan practices. So I looked at the way in which the most visible amateur collectors and also people who are involved in different forms of sharing, say with online websites or having their own swap meets for swapping or buying and selling vintage radio sets, how there is a skewing in terms of visibility towards groups of predominantly middle to older age or retirement age, white middle class men in the North American and Western European context. And so part of what I was trying to do there is also think about you know, which acts of saving and sharing, you know, gain a certain visibility with online websites, with large numbers of members. And perhaps there are other less organized or less visible collecting and fan practices that we may be overlooking as a result. So part of what I was trying to do is take what we call a feminist media studies approach and also a more kind of critical global media studies approach to say, like, okay, well, there's every reason to assume that there have also been, for instance, in the North American context, I think Black American amateur radio fans and clubs with clubhouses, but perhaps they haven't been narrated as much in national history. So I really went digging a bit, and I looked at a very helpful encyclopedia of African American radio that told me about all the different amateur clubs that were set up. And I did some other digging and found other traces of Black American teenage girls who were into amateur radio. So I tried to also think about how we have traces, very faint traces sometimes in the archive or in certain circulations, but that it's important to make sense of, let's say, the less visible, but not at all less important situations where we see attachments to radio and fan practices, particularly when it comes to sharing a love of radio.
Yeah, so again, poking at that narrative and really not undermining it as much as expanding the categories. And so who else was sharing radio and who else was engaging in those practices? So you finish the book with a discussion of affect and some kind of theoretical framings. You use Lauren Berlant and Arjuna Padarai and a few others as well. And so my sense of what you were trying to do in that last bit is sort of working through the question of, you know, affect posed as a sort of nonverbal or preverbal or almost, I don't know, a universal kind of human, you know, experience, and then the very constructedness and specificities that you point out sort of over and over again throughout the book. And so, and I think that what you were trying to do, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of balance, sure, come to a balance between those two and sort of engage those in a sort of dialogue. And I would love to hear more about how you worked through those questions.
Sure thing. So it's interesting. There was a real fashion for thinking about affect in relationship to sound over the past 10 to 15 years. And I guess in an early moment, first coming into sound studies, first encountering a very, you know, persuasive accounts about affect and sound, often influenced by the work of Brian Massumi and others. I guess earlier on, I was quite charmed by some of those accounts and also took them on board. And I guess coming back to this question of affect and emotion when in developing the theoretical framework for radiophilia, I started to feel that some of this insistence in some of affect theory on the pre-linguistic, the pre-verbal, the split second, as productive as I know it has been for a lot of scholars, it wasn't really helping me with the things I want to think about. So I, you know, really for the first time in quite some time, I returned to the field of affect studies and the history of emotions. And these two fields, I had to kind of catch up what would have been the most recent discussions. And I found a really helpful book by Margaret Wetherill, which tries to find a kind of a third way. So, you know, reads the latest work from neuroscience about affect and emotion, and really tries to take on the arguments from affect theory and the history of emotions, and does weigh a little bit more on the side of, I would say, the practice theory approach of the history of emotions. In a way, suggests that some aspects of affect theory might sound really appealing, but they don't really add up to what practically the neuroscience is telling us in the latest results. So what she does, I think, really helpfully is that she comes up with a concept of effective practice. So trying to understand affect and emotion as relational events taking place in social life and involving performance and sociality. So having a similar spirit to affect theory, but not trying to make the same calls that you're always looking for the kind of, in a way, the pre-verbal, the pre-linguistic moment, but rather kind of shifting to say, like, what do people do with affect? How does it in a way take form in you know, in social acts or in these moments of expression or performance? I found that to be more productive for this book. So not necessarily to dismiss it, but to sort of fold affect into a larger kind of continuum, let's say. And so, yeah, how does that then influence what I'm trying to do in the conclusion? I think what it's doing is that by the time I got to the conclusion of the book, I started to wonder, even though I have moments in the book where I say, listen, radiophilia can be a sustained practice for a given amount of time, or it can be, kind of reinforced through habit and practice, but it could also be a fleeting moment. And I tried to sort of also say, it can be about positive affects and about love, but it can be also about people who are socially, physically, or geographically isolated, and that actually it could be that you're in a situation of war or conflict or social unrest and isolation, and that you actually, you know, may actually have other emotions feeding in to your attachment to radio. So that could be fear or anxiety. So it doesn't always necessarily have to be about love per se. And I guess I was trying to also say that loving radio isn't always just a good thing. So, you know, it could be that, you know, we have a situation of obsession with radio, you know, in a situation of hate speech through radio or through other forms of politicized misuse of radio. So I tried to at least throughout the book say, like, yes, we're thinking about this attachment, but the attachment might not always just be love, but mixed with other emotions. And it might not always be just a wholesale positive development that we're making sense of here. And I guess by the conclusion, by engaging with the work of Lauren Berlant, who wrote a book called Desire/Love in the early 2000s, and Arjen Apadure's Modernity at Large and other writings from the 90s onwards, it's kind of a reckoning that I'm trying to have. And I found that those two scholars' work was really helpful for me to kind of think about both the kind of productive capacity of this radiophilia, that's more on the side of Arjen Apadure, thinking about imagination and the different ways in which perhaps media, but in this case radio, you know, is about transnational media flows and media consumption across national borders, that it might be a space for the imagination, for fantasy and world making, that listeners may experience pleasure, joy, or comfort. And as he says, that such embodied expressions, practices, and collective formations through media allow groups to, as he says, quote, to imagine and feel things together. So that's really this kind of like all of the kind of potential that we might find with radio. But in a way, Lauren Berlant's work is also kind of asking us to think about ideologies of love, about the kind of industrial context of the entertainment industries, about, in a way, I guess, to warn us against any kind of naive celebration of radio as a free space for the formation of love, affection, or attachment. So in a way, these two scholars are helping me kind of think between radiophilia as this kind of, in a way, productive, expansive potential for connecting listeners, you know, across space and time. And Berlant is reminding us that you know, that we always have to be a little bit cautious when we think about the ways in which, in a way, love and desire operate in, let's say, the 20th century, like the long 20th century, in the context of global capitalism.
Yeah, and of course, you're not going to end triumphantly. So I really like that turn at the end, because it just sort of pushes everything a little bit deeper, and turns everything that we've just read a little bit on its side. And I think that's really productive.
Great.
I've taken up so much of your time. Is there anything else I haven't asked you about that you'd like to mention before we close?
Wow. I mean, I guess perhaps I would just add, as a kind of final thing, like, even though I wrote this as a book about radio, I'm hoping that it's also a book that contributes to the larger project of sound studies. And in a way, even though I feel still a bit modest about how much I contribute to the larger projects that some of our colleagues have called for, of remapping sound studies and questioning certain Western epistemologies of sound, at least I hope I've taken steps to thinking with that work and asking what does that mean for our study of radio across the radio century. So I guess, as much as it is a radio book, and extending into contemporary podcasting and digital audio formats, I do hope that it really is productive for the field of sound studies, as well as the other fields that I've mentioned already today, like fan studies that historically hasn't discussed radio, and, you know, in dialogue with, say, feminist media studies and like a global media studies field of research. So at least that's my ambition, is to also write a book where radio is taken serious for the larger project of, say, media and cultural history and media and cultural analysis, and also, yeah, contribute to the discussions we've been having in other adjacent fields.
Thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Alejandra.